different stuff up there, and we have paraphrased a little section out of the last paragraph to fit our needs here tonight. So, listen up, real important here. If you have a drinking problem, we hope that you may pause in hearing this story tonight and think one of three things. Yes, that happened to me. Or more important, yes, I felt like that. Or most important, yes, I believe this program can work for me too. So, tonight's speaker is a good friend of mine, Trey. I had the pleasure of meeting him probably somewhere around 6 months ago. And Trey lives this program. You know, there's a lot of people, that come into these rooms and they talk a lot, you know, and they go out after the meeting and they don't know how to live what's in that book, you know. And this guy lives this program. He got sober, he opened up a sober living house, you know, and I've seen this guy give his heart and his soul to this program and helping other people. You know, and I don't know about you guys, for me, a man was somebody that had a nice car, had to have a six-figure job, you know, all those things. And this guy helps me sort of shift what I think a man is, you know. He's a man, he helps people, you know. He puts his heart and soul into his relationships, and it's a beautiful thing. You know, I've seen this guy make a lot of changes in different people, you know, help them come to their God, and it's a beautiful thing, man. Real excited to hear his story, and with that, I give you Trey.
Thank you, Bob. It's good to know that I do not have a nice car, I do not have a six-figure job, and but I am a man, so he told me, you know, to speak at this meeting, you have to do your hair just like Bob. So I did my best. I shaved it, all that stuff. Everybody, my name's Trey, and I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Trey.
When I say that, it always pisses somebody off somewhere. Somebody in this room is pissed off because I said the word recovered. But on page 17 of this book, my sponsor pointed out, he said, look there, it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who are just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered, and they solved the drink problem. And, man, I highlighted the word recovered and the word solved, because that's what I needed. And I was so sick of trying to live life and have a little bit of success and then a lot of failure, and a little bit of success and a lot of failure, and you know, I wondered, is this roller coaster going to continue forever? Or is there really a way to step off it and live a happy life? And I didn't know that it meant sobriety. As a matter of fact, when I came in to recovery, I intentionally and purposefully came in to stop smoking crack cocaine. I did not come in to stop drinking. And I told everybody that. And now I realize why they are all smiling. You know? I told the people at the rehab I went to, you know, I am not here to stop drinking. I'm not going to stop drinking. Can I drink while I'm here? Drinking is not my problem. You know? And I found that was a big part of it. But they told me right up front that I suffered from a fatal and a progressive disease. That means it gets worse over time, and it ends in death. And it's not alcoholism. It's Treyism. And don't worry, you don't have it. You know, unless your name is Trey. But I didn't understand that. And I'm going to spend a few minutes just telling you a little bit about what I was like, and then what happened to change the course of my life, and what I'm like now. I grew up in a great family. My parents are still married. Have two brothers, both younger. Very, very religious family. We went to church on Sunday, and Sunday night, and Wednesday, and Thursday. And Saturday, we spent most of the day getting prepared for Sunday of school. You know, I mean, it was all the time, constant biblical household. And it was something that as a kid I really embraced. because it's what everybody did, and I was afraid. I didn't want to go to hell, and I wanted to please my parents. I had a real strong desire for them to be proud of me, and that has continued my whole life. And so early on, embracing the church lifestyle was what I did. And some of the things that, if I look back now, really developed early on, that kind of are explained by my alcoholism, but I wanted to do what I wanted to do all of the time. And I got in trouble a lot. And I distinctly remember a lot of specific times when I was told over and over that I'd have to learn how to conform, I'd have to learn how to obey, I'd have to submit to authority, and that really rubbed me the wrong way. And especially when it came to the church thing, as I became a teenager, I started to pull back. I went to Christian school for most of my life, private Christian school, and in high school I got to go to a public school. And I got to see, wow, you know, there's other kids and they're having fun and they're not going to church and they're not doing what I did, and I started to pull away. And at age 19, I made the decision to leave home because my parents said, you either go to church on Sunday and Wednesday and Thursday and Saturday, or you have to leave. You can't live here. And it made the decision for me. And that plays a lot into later on when I actually came into recovery and was faced with God again. I had a whole lot of prejudice based on my growing up. But anyway, at 17, I met a girl, and her name was Katrina. And I met her at church, of course. That's where I was all the time. And the Oxford group, I don't know if you studied any AA history, they early on, guys tested the guidance they would get in their thinking by how they measured it up against God's will. And the test they used for God's will was honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. And I would say this woman fit every one of those characteristics. She was the kindest, sweetest person I've ever met, very innocent, and now she also was with me, which made her stupid. but she was still one of the finest human beings that I've ever known, and it really made it much more tragic, all the harm that I brought to her. But we started dating on October 22nd in 1988. And we dated for 10 years. She lost her virginity to me on our wedding night, 10 years after we started dating. Now, I lost my virginity to a Mexican hooker in Las Vegas when I was like, so we didn't quite share the same values, but it just goes to show you that, you know, she was very codependent. But shortly after we started, and this has something to do with the story, shortly after we started dating, I had my first drink. And I drank, waited till I was 21, and had my first drink, and it was peach schnapps. It was at a poker game, and the warmth came over me, the feeling came over me. I don't have to describe it to you guys. I knew right then what Bill talked about when he said, I discovered alcohol. I mean, I discovered it. It was like, wow, I've been waiting for this my whole life, this feeling. And, you know, I felt the way a lot of people have. I didn't fit in. You know, I put on this big character around people because I wanted people to like me so much. And I felt like I never was good enough. No one really liked me, and which is part of why I got in trouble a lot as a kid too, because I was doing everything to get your attention and to get your approval. And when I started drinking, I got it, whether you gave it to me or not. It didn't matter. I mean, that feeling, I just loved that feeling. And in the book, it tells us, you know, men and women drink essentially because we like the effects produced by alcohol. When I read that for the first time, hell yeah. The effects produced by alcohol were amazing to me. And I didn't know that there was any other way to get what I got from alcohol. And I didn't care. And so right then, I began a many, many year string of continual drinking. Now, the continual drinking does not make me an alcoholic. You know, I did not know that. There's a lot of definitions and a lot of misconceptions about what an alcoholic is. And I like to go with the definition in the big book and how it describes different types of alcoholics. It describes people that are you know, just moderate drinkers and then heavy drinkers. And then somewhere along the way, we cross a line. And it's like this invisible line that we cross where when we want to stop drinking, we honestly want to quit, but we find that we can't. And I crossed that line early on, very, very early on. I was accepted to Georgia Tech, and I attended Georgia Tech, didn't graduate. Can you guess why I didn't graduate? It was drinking. I drank and I didn't show up for class, and my grade point average dropped and I was kicked out. I had always been interested in computers, and I got a job for a little computer company. But one of the things, probably at age 8, I got really interested in was magic tricks. And it really helped me as I started performing magic. It helped me develop this person that people liked. I mean, people were interested in. When I would do something and you couldn't figure it out and I amazed you, well, you would clap, you know, and you would smile at me. And that's what I was looking for. And that became a real intense part of my personality. And what I did was I always had to entertain. I mean, when I walked into a room, if you weren't looking at me, I had to do something to make you look at me. And once I started drinking, you know, some of that just subsided, and I also realized I could just buy you a drink, you know, and then you would like me. And that became a big part of what I did in my business career. But I continued working in computers, and I ended up getting a job as an IT director for a company that we developed some new software, and we had to sell it all over the place, all over the country. And I got to travel. And as I traveled to different cities, I started performing magic professionally, and also did some stand-up comedy, and got to do that as part of my travels. I would go to a city, I would work, I would do a gig, I would get drunk, and it was great. And for a number of years, I was able to maintain that. I don't know if you want to call that a functional alcoholic. On the outside, I was able to work. I was able to maintain a relationship with Katrina somewhat. It was never a faithful relationship. I was able to drink and somehow get up the next morning and do it all again. If that's functioning, if that's living to you, then I guess that's what I was. But the thing nobody saw was inside, I was rotted out. I mean, there was nothing there. Everything about me was fake. Everything. The person that you knew, the personality that I put on, everything was fake. There was nothing real. And I wasn't really necessarily aware of it. I mean, every day it was get up, drink, put on the show, go to work, come back. I mean, it was just a cycle that lasted for so long. The company that I worked for as an IT director was a medical company, and we sold some medical software, and it was a behavioral medicine practice. And one day I was having lunch with one of the therapists, she was a drug counselor, and she asked me, she said, have you ever tried cocaine? I said, no, I haven't. And she said, would you like to? And I said, well, yes, I would. And but I was puzzled. I said, you run these drug counseling sessions for these people, right? And I didn't really know much about drugs. I had smoked some marijuana, but that was it. And she said, how are you going to help these people if you don't know what they're going through? And that makes complete sense. That sounds good to me. So thus began my career of snorting cocaine. And And life just took off at a rapid pace. And I was snorting cocaine. I was drinking my smoking weed every day. After that, it just everything started snowballing, and my ability to function began to decline. Nobody thinks it's funny when the comedian doesn't show up for his gig, you know, or the magician doesn't show up. So I did that a few times, and I started losing all of that. That career went down the tubes very quickly. I was able to maintain my job as an IT director, but I performed it very poorly. And so it went for about a year. And the first time I smoked crack cocaine was completely by accident. I pulled into this place where I bought weed every day, and it was a liquor store, weirdly enough. I would get some alcohol, and I would pull up and roll down my window, and the guy came up to the car, and I said, "Give me six dimes," you know, and I gave him $60, and he came back, and in six instead of dime bags of weed, he dropped six rocks at me. I was like, "Huh." And I learned you don't argue with drug dealers. You know? So I was like, "Thank you very much." And I drove off, and I'm just sitting here driving down the street like this. I didn't know what to do with it. Pulled out my weed pipe, dropped one in, and it hit me, man. It was another one of those experiences like alcohol. And I said, "This is what I want. This is it. This is what I want." And, you know, I get what I want in my world. When I find something that I like, I will get it. And it doesn't matter what the costs are. It doesn't matter what law I have to break. It doesn't matter what relationship I trample all over. It doesn't matter who I hurt. It doesn't matter. I get what I want. And right then, that first hit, people say, "You're addicted to crack the first time you smoke it," or you hear things like that. I was addicted to crack before I ever smoked it. I'm addicted to everything before I ever do it, because my addiction lies within me. It is deep-seated within me. It has very little to do with what the substance is. And I did not know that at the time. And I turned around, I went back to that liquor store, and I said, "Give me six more dimes of whatever this is, you know, and your phone number." Thus began that part of my journey. Now, I will tell you, drugs played a huge part of my story, but alcohol was always there. When I ran out of money or when I lost my connections, there was always the liquor store. Always. Jack Daniels was always sitting on the shelf, and it always was the same. The quality never changed. And I still don't know why you can go down to the Caribbean and buy Tennessee whiskey cheaper than you can in Tennessee. But, you know, I mean, I've bought it all over the place. That was my thing. Alcohol and then these drugs and everything started going downhill. I still traveled, and I started, because of my crack addiction, it started taking me into some really seedy places. In a lot of cities that I had no business being in. I would go for work, I would set up my trade show booth, set my business cards on the table, and I was gone. It was a week-long show. I showed up the first day, and I showed up the last day. And then the rest of it, I was out finding every drug spot that I could. I would get my alcohol. I could sit here and tell you story after story of extremely violent situations, of extremely dangerous situations, of extremely sad situations, but I think y'all probably know all that stuff. There was times I was in Las Vegas, and I went into a motel room to buy some crack, and there was a dead prostitute just laying there on the bed. And if she wasn't dead, she's a really good actress. I mean, she was not moving, you know, and I was just, I'm in this situation, I'm buying dope. How did I get here? How did I, this kid that grew up in this great home with Christian parents and were taught all these values, how am I standing here in this rundown motel with, you know, this kind of situation all around me? And I think that it's completely normal. I mean, this progression, it happened so slowly over time that, and so often that I found myself in all kinds of situations that if you just told somebody out on the street, this is what I'm doing, they would be shocked. But to me, it was completely normal. This life became a very normal one for me. It became normal after I made the best decision in my life at that point that I'd ever made, and I married Katrina. And she made the worst decision she ever made and said yes, you know, and we got married and in 1998. And by that time, I had been arrested already for felony possession of cocaine. And, you know, I thought she would have left me, but it really magnified how sick she was. And something I learned later on, I didn't know it then, that people that stay with people like me are sick. She had a sickness of very deep codependence and several other things that she didn't even know she had until she got in recovery later on. But she married, and we tried to put together this happy life. We had a little house in a little neighborhood with a, you know, white mailbox and all these different things. And she was living her life. She was getting up. She was going to church on Sunday. She was doing all the things that she believed in and that she wanted to do. And I was living my life. And I tried to smoke crack in the house and sneak around so she wouldn't find me. She, you know, I was the only man she knew that took like 3-hour baths every night. You know, I'm soaking. You know, and after a while she started catching on because she knew about the drug charges and things just started to look really fishy. And my ability to lie and hide started to slip. And she started to figure things out. And so I had a basement, and my goal was I'm going to create the ultimate crack den down in this basement. So I go down there, and I told her. I said, all right, I'm going to be going down to the basement every night, and you're going to hear stuff down there. I said, but what I'm doing is making you a surprise, okay? So don't come down, okay? Don't come down. And she's like, all right, you know, and this lasted for months. And so I would go down in the basement, you know, and I would, you know, drill a power to drill and then turn on a saw and hammer something. Then I'd run over and, you know, smoke crack and set up my crack den. And I had alcohol and I had all my stuff down there. And she would never come down. It was, I think that she had this sick feeling somewhere in her that something wrong was going on. But when she started questioning me, I came up with this great idea that I was going to paint the stairs. And so as I would back down to go down for the night, I would paint a stair. And then I would paint the next stair. And when I got to the bottom, I would go, you know, wet paint, don't come down. And yes. Kept her out. Of course, then I couldn't get back up. You know, so I had to wait till it dried. And those stairs got about 42 coats of paint on them. It was like the thickest. I did it every night. I painted the stair. And, you know, after a while, I think she probably figured out, I'm thinking I've put on the greatest, you know, the greatest scheme and the greatest manipulation, and I got her totally fooled. I had a bunch of friends. I had developed, I don't know if you'd call them friends. I called them friends. They were really acquaintances. They drank with me. Some of them smoked pot with me. Some of them snorted coke with me. But after a period of time, they started to fade away. I mean, my addiction, I became very reclusive. I started to pull back. I was always out of control when I was out in public and around people. You know, they would drive down the street. I would be throwing beer bottles out the window and doing stuff to attract attention. And nobody wanted me to be around. And one by one, those friends dropped off. And, when, you know, I'm sure you've heard this before. You know, when your drinking buddies tell you you got a problem, you got a problem. You know, when your drinking buddies don't want to be around you anymore because you're out of control, then why don't we see it? I didn't see it. I just thought they had a problem. You know, they couldn't handle their shit. You know, and so I ended up, I don't know how I got it, but I had this cardboard like life-size cardboard cutout of Chewbacca. And he was down there in the basement with me. And after a while, you know, Katrina wouldn't talk with me. She slipped into this thing where she would sit on the couch all day and read and eat. And I think she slipped into an extremely deep depression. And because I was in the basement all the time. And so Chewbacca kept me company. I mean, he was my smoking buddy. And me and Chewbacca were down there. And then the day came that Katrina had a trip out of town. And I had just recently, I'd made good money. Well, let me just back up a little bit. I made good money at this job where I traveled and did all this stuff. I was working 3 days a week, and that's all I had to do. 3 days a week. I could pick the days. They didn't care. I made $80,000 a year plus. I had an unlimited expense account and lots of bonuses. I did have a six-figure job, and I did have a nice car at that time. And that's all I had to do was show up. 3 days a week. That's it. And I got to the point with my addiction where I couldn't even do that. Katrina made pretty good money. We both made about six figures, and we couldn't even make a $900 mortgage payment. And she didn't understand why. But I spent it all on dope. Because our bills and our home that I was supposed to be providing for her, that got in the way of my using. And see, anything that gets, I wanted to get drunk. I wanted to get high. I wanted to live like this. So if you got in my way, F you. You know, and if you're a creditor, F you. You know, and if you're my wife that I'm supposed to love, whose dad I went to and said, you know, I will take care of your daughter. If you'll let me marry her, you know, F you too. This addiction was more than just drinking and using. There was a personality that had developed inside of me that was evil. And I thought I was the nicest guy you'd ever meet. You know, and I was a pretty nice guy, but you know, I was a very selfish guy. And so the day came that she had a trip out of town, and I stole some cash out of her purse, and she got to where she was going. We couldn't use our credit cards because I'd maxed them all out. And she got there and didn't have the money to pay for her hotel because I'd stolen it to go buy dope, and that was it. She left me and told me, "You got to get some help. You got to get some help or I'm not coming back." And I'm like, "That's fine. I got Chewbacca." And so I went downstairs, and I'll be damned, it had rained the night before, and our basement had flooded. And Chewbacca was floating in pieces in a pool of water, and there went my smoking buddy. I mean, I had nobody. It was just me. And that was okay. You know, that was me. I just isolated down there for about a week, and then finally my family intervened on me and said, "You got to get some help." And they didn't understand. They didn't understand addiction. When I would get arrested, they would come down there. My mom, she would see me and pass out. And they had the DeKalb County Jail, the Fulton County Jail, I mean, at Henry County Jail, every jail that I went to, she would walk in, see me, and pass out. Because she couldn't handle it. I mean, they lived their life a certain way. They taught me, you know, this is how you live and be successful and be happy. And I didn't do it. And they clung to that Bible verse. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart from it. You know. And they thought that meant I would just be good all my life. But they missed the part that said, when he's old. You know. Before that, you know, all bets are off. And I was living life however I wanted. And they didn't understand it. So they got a pamphlet from MAR, this rehab center. Like, you need to go talk to these people. So I went to go see this guy. His name's Larry Jenkins. He's a big, big guy, big black guy. I'm the skinny, cracked out white kid. And I'm sitting in front of him, and he's sitting back and goes, "Trey, you know what your problem is?" And I said, "I smoke too much crack and drink too much Jack Daniels." And he said, "No." He goes, "Your problem is you." And when he did this, like the wind from his hand pushed me back. And I said, it just went right over my head. The problem is not me. The problem is these things that I can't control. And once I can figure out how to control them, I'll be fine. I started to, you know, when I left that meeting with him, he told my mom that my parents together, but said it basically to my mom that they would probably go to my funeral. And she passed out again. Moms don't like that stuff. And I'm sitting there thinking, because he told me at that time, he said, if you come into this rehab, you can't use and you can't drink. You know, and I couldn't imagine my life without drinking. I mean, how am I going to celebrate New Year's Eve? How am I going to celebrate the Super Bowl? How am I going to celebrate Tuesday? You know, I mean, you know, I drink every day. You know, it's just like, what? You know, how am I going to do this? So I get into this rehab, and I did have my last chunk of change left over from this job, which I got fired from, and I paid to go into this rehab, $20,000, and they hand me this $7.50 book, and they told me to go to free AA meetings. So I felt like I got gypped a little bit. But I go in there and I sit down, and these guys tell me, you need to get a sponsor, you know. And I didn't know what a sponsor was and how to get a sponsor. It sounded like I'm asking somebody out on a date, you be my sponsor, you know. And so I go to these meetings and I sit down, and I'm in one of these singleness of purpose meetings where you don't talk about anything but alcohol. You don't say I'm an addict, man. They'll just like give you the evil eye. So I'm sitting there, and this guy raises his hand. He says, hey, my name's Justin, and I'm an alcoholic. And I go, hiya, Justin. And he goes, oh, and I love to smoke cocaine. And he was a home group member, and he just did that to piss off the old timers. But I said, you know, I'm like, I love to smoke cocaine too. I'm going to talk to that guy. You know, and I don't believe things. I don't believe in coincidences anymore. And I get the point behind singleness of purpose meetings. But that guy's little joke right there drew me to him. And I went to him, and I said, I'm supposed to get a sponsor. You know, I'm in this rehab. Is that something you do? And he's like, yeah. And so we started off through this book. And, he talked about God. And I wanted to get up and run, because I had spent, from 19 years old when I left my parents' house, I had spent my whole life doing what I wanted to do, and that did not involve the mention of God. I was sick of church, I was sick of God. And if this is how you get sober, I don't want it. I don't want it. But I also wanted my parents to be proud of me, which is the main reason I'm in rehab at this point. And so I listened to him, and I learned a lot of things, and I took a few notes and highlighted some shit, and I got an A in recovery. I got an A. I smiled. I told them everything they wanted to hear. I was in a 90-day program, and saved up some change, because they could take your money from you, and so saved up a little change. And the whole time I was there, I had what they described in the blue book as a lurking notion. I knew in the back of my head I was going to drink again. There was no question. I didn't know when, I didn't know how, but I knew I was going to drink again. And 90-day program, man, day 89, the night before I was supposed to leave, I told my community, I'm like, guys, it has been real. Thank you for the information. I am going home. Katrina needed me. You know, she really did. She had moved back into our house by this time since I was gone. And she had this hope, you know, that I was going to come back different. And so I get in my car, driving home at about 10 o'clock at night, and I'm passing Cleveland Avenue exit, you know, and it felt like a tractor beam just kind of pulled my car off the interstate and right back into the hood. And I was off to the races. I got home, I was high, she was still in denial. She lasted about another month or so, and then she was gone. I met this guy named Ramsey Pitcock. He was my roommate in Mar, and I'd relapsed, and I was out there, and he gave me a call a couple months later. I just spent every day back in the cycle. I cashed in my 401k, which was all I had left, and it was about 80 grand, and I just started blowing it like crazy on dope and on alcohol. God, I had a nice bar in my house. I didn't have to leave, because I couldn't leave. You know, I had guys bringing me stuff, and all my alcohol was there. It's been about 7 months of absolute hell. Ramsey called up. He was getting out of rehab, and I invited him over. I'm like, come on, man. come to my place. I got a sack of dope. I got alcohol here. Come on. And he came over and we got drunk and we got high. And we laughed about the guys that were still in rehab. We laughed about all that shit they taught us. And we got drunk and we got high. And ultimately, Ramsey had to move back back to South Georgia. I was there by myself. And I had a day, and it was a really bad day, that came. I had spent all my money, and I stole some gas so I could go get some dope. And they didn't give me any dope. And I didn't have any money. I had to steal the gas to get there, and they didn't front me. So I came back home, and I'm sitting there in my house, and I got a knock on the door. And it was like three knocks that day. This is like the Christmas Carol with the ghosts, the three ghosts that come to visit you, and they were all three cops, which sucks in this story. The first one, I opened the door, and it was a cop. And he said, you know, the BP station where you go every day, where they know you by name up the street, that you stole the gas at and thought you were going to get away from it, they want their gas back. Or they want their money. I mean, I don't know why I did that, because I knew they would know me. But this was just alcoholism in action. And so they said, you bring him his $11 by the end of the day, I'm coming back and arresting you. And I'm like, all right. And I didn't have $11. You know, I didn't know where I was going to get that money. And the next knock came. It was about an hour or two later, and it was a sheriff. And he was delivering foreclosure papers. They were foreclosing on my house. And they'd already cut off the power at that point. Still had the water. But they were now foreclosing on that. And that was a big deal to me to have my own house. And I was losing that. And then the last knock came not long after that. And it was the same damn sheriff. And I can't figure out why he didn't just do two things at one time. But he came back, and he brought me divorce papers. And that was it. That pushed me over the edge. Katrina was divorcing me. And it's like, at that moment, you know how you feel when things are caving in? It was all caving in. And I'm sitting there. I'm going to jail because I don't have $11. I'm losing my house. The woman that I'd been with for 17 years at this point was leaving me. Life wasn't worth living. And I got a carpet cutter, and I went in the bathroom, and I just started cutting to my wrist, and I cut it a lot. And I nicked a few tendons. I had to have a little surgery. But I cut it, and I bled, and I wanted to die. And I sat in the bathtub, turning on the hot water, and I passed out. And I didn't die. In case you were wondering, I woke up. I don't know how much time had passed, and my wrists had pretty much stopped bleeding. And I thought, either heaven looks like the inside of my bathroom, or I fucked this up too. You know, I can't do anything right. You know, and I'm like, what do you do? This was my escape plan, and yet here I'm still am. And I called my dad, and I said, you got to help me. He got to help me, and he came, and he got me. We got stitched up, took me to Anchor Hospital for 5 days, and then he said, you know what? We're done with you. We're done with you. We have done everything we're going to do. We've done all the money, all the love, all the help we're going to throw at you. You got to do this for yourself, or not at all. And I asked him, can I come stay with you? No. Everything was no. Can I have a MARTA token? No. There was nothing. They got up and they left and said, have a nice life. And that was the hardest thing they've ever had to do. And I had a decision to make. You know, I'm either going to go live on the street or I'm going to get sober. And so I begged him to take me back to Mar. I talked to Larry Jenkins, and he got me back in. Didn't have any money this time. I had to borrow some money just to put a down payment on it. And I went in, and they said, what are you going to do different this time? And I came up with all these excuses, you know. And they said, how about getting honest? How about surrender? And I didn't know what that meant, because that sounds like giving up, you know. And picked up a white chip at the Mount Vernon meeting, and a turner in a big meeting, speaker meeting, got to walk down this little middle aisle, and I got my chip, and I'm coming back, and there standing Justin at the back of the room, guy who had sponsored me before, and he was just grinning, I like to talk about in the big book, those AA people like to grin at you, you know. And he was grinning at me because he knew. He knew I had, one thing I left out was after I'd cut my wrist and gotten out of that hospital, I'd gotten beat up a couple times by drug dealers trying to go down and get some dope with no money. And I had two black eyes and an eye patch on one. And I mean, I looked really shot out, you know. And I said, are you willing to take me back through this? And he said, if you're going to get honest with me and do this, he says, I'm more than happy to do it. If you're going to bullshit me and half-ass like you did before, there's no point. And I said, I'll do whatever you tell me to do. He said, all right. And so we got this book out. And man, so I picked that white chip up August 3rd of 05. And we went through this book, man. And I can tell you what it describes on, what is it, 567? Spiritual experience. I don't know what you're here for. But I came in here, and he said, you got to have a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. I'm telling you right now, if you hadn't had enough pain, I wish you all the pain you could stand. Because I had it enough. And I needed a change. And I needed a change so drastic that you wouldn't even recognize me. And I didn't know how to do it. How do you change your life? People told me that. You need to change your life. Okay, how do you do that? I can't wrap my brain around that. Man, the people that wrote this book took change in your life and broke it down into 12 simple steps. That's all they did. And he handed this to me, and we read through it. He goes, you don't have to be intimidated by God and religion and all this stuff. He goes, this is real simple. He gave me this chapter, We Agnostics. He says, you're an agnostic. Read this. Because I thought I was so intelligent. I went to Georgia Tech. Didn't graduate, but I went to Georgia Tech. And I had all these philosophies and ideas and logic. And I would tell you why, you know, you say black, I say white. And I could argue it every time. And I read this chapter, and it broke it down. It told me that, you know, I tried, I wanted to be sober, but I just didn't have the power to do it. It's like, you don't believe it? Get sober. I couldn't get sober. I went to doctors. My parents sent me to damn psychiatrists, and they didn't do anything to fix me. There wasn't another human being I met that could fix me. And so this book says, I don't have the power to do it, and I got to find a power that can do it for me. And I'm like, okay, how do you do that? And Justin's like, well, read the next sentence. I'm like, okay. That's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power that will solve your problem. There's that word solve again. And I'm like, okay, so this book is going to help me find a power to solve my problem. Where am I going to find that? Because it says, where and how are we going to find this power? It's flipped over to page 55, a few pages later, and it tells me right where the power is. This book provides the questions, the ones I did ask, and then the ones I didn't even think to ask. And then it provides all the answers, every one of them. I have not run into a problem yet that has where the answer has not been found in the principles in this book. I haven't run into one yet. And he took me through this book. And I mean, I'd love to sit here and run through every experience I had with all 12 steps, but we don't have time. I spent too much time talking about the bullshit, but that's what happens sometimes. I can tell you one thing I did do when I got to step two, and I really had a problem with it, with the God thing. You know, and he showed me that, and I said, I can't believe in something I don't see. I really have a problem believing. I can't have this blind faith. And he said, that's okay. And I said, well, I don't see God. I don't see it. How can I believe it? He goes, where are you looking? Are you looking at your own life? Are you looking at all the things you've done in your life, trying to find this evidence of God? He says, honestly, there's a lot of people that can look at your life and see lots of evidence of God. But you're blind to that right now. He says, so why don't you just look in the lives of people where God has been working miracles? Why don't you look at me, my sponsor, who was a desperate alcoholic and crack addict just like me, and now he wasn't. Now he's a successful, recovered human being. And how about all these other people? And he he says, look at them, people that I've gotten to know in the program. That's why we go to meetings. We don't go to meetings to get sober. Meeting makers make meetings. They don't get sober. They come to meetings to meet people, to meet sponsors, to have fellowship. And then the sponsors take us through this book. That's how we get sober. He said, all these people you've met in these meetings, this network of numbers you've been writing down, why don't you get to know some of these people? Because God is working in their life. You want evidence of God? Nicole's one of them. I mean, there's people that were right there at the very beginning for me that I just, all I had to do was look at them. I was looking in the wrong place. The evidence for me to believe was right in front of me. And then, are you willing to do it? Are you willing to do this work? You got to make a decision. Do you want to do what you've been doing, or you want to do something different? So I took step 3, and I took step 4, you know? I wrote this list of all these resentments and all these people and places and institutions and principles that had pissed me off. And then I had to look at my part in every one of those things. I'd look at how fear, I was so fear-driven my whole life. I had to look at all these things, look at harms I did to other people. And I really didn't like to do that, but I did it anyway, because he told me, you're going to do this thoroughly, or we're not going to do it at all. We're not going to half-ass, half-measure. We're not going to do this. We're going to do it thoroughly or not at all. I said, okay. Got to the 9th step. I wanted to do my amends on Facebook. You know? It's like, to everybody out there, and you know who you are, my bad. You know? That was going to be my post, you know? And he said, no, you can't do that. We got to go one-on-one. So I had to go, and I had to go to these people, and I had to meet with them one-on-one, and I had to tell them, except there was one person, the number one person on my list that I'd harmed the most. It was Katrina, and she didn't want to see me. So he said, write her a letter. So I wrote her this letter. It was just great. It was my masterpiece of letter, and I read it 100 times. And I said, when she reads this letter, my phone is going to ring. Well, my phone wasn't going to ring because I was still in rehab, and I didn't have a number you could call. But something was going to happen, you know. Something was going to happen. She was going to come crawling back to me. And so I went to the therapist, the family counselor, Mara, and I said, here's this letter. It's the ninth, my 9th step. Got to give this to Katrina. And will you please do that? And I did not like this woman already for a lot of different reasons. But she said, yes, I'll do it. So I gave it to her, and I'm waiting, and I'm waiting, and I'm waiting. And there was nothing. No response. So I went back to her about a week later. I'm like, did you give Katrina the letter? Because I was thinking she didn't even give it to her. I'm like, did you give her the letter? I told you how important this was. And she pulled it out and she set it on her desk. And I said, damn it. And I went off on her. All these spiritual principles I had been working up to this point disappeared, and I let her have it. And she just let me go. And when I was done, she said, do you want to know why I didn't give it to her? And I said, yeah. She goes, because she didn't want it. She didn't want it. And I was devastated. And I went back to Justin and I said, I can't do the 9th step. I can't make this amends, the number one amends on my list, because this woman does not want my letter. And he goes, you made your amends when you wrote it. He said, the book talks about you have to make an honest attempt to do this. But you can't, the reaction of the other person makes no difference whatsoever. Whether they embrace you and forgive you, or whether they kick you out of their office, or whether they don't take it at all. And I still have that letter sitting on my bedside table. It's never been delivered. And I made my amends. And so we worked through step 10. He told me what to do every day. We worked through step 11, and he taught me how to meditate. I mean, really meditate. Get out a piece of paper and pray and get guidance, write it down, and apply some of these tests of my thoughts to see what's from God and what's just out of my crazy brain. And, I mean, we worked on this hard. And when we got to step 12, he shook my hand. He says, congratulations, according to this book, you've recovered from that hopeless state. And yeah, I was hopeless. A hopeless state of mind and body that you came in here with. He says, and now you got 2 weeks to get your ass a sponsee, because this big book tells us this is how you're going to stay sober. It tells us there is nothing that is going to keep us sober like intensive work with other alcoholics. Nothing. So you want to continue calling me and work with me? This is what you got to do. And that's what I did. And I've taken a lot of guys through the steps. And a real small percentage of them have stayed sober. But I've stayed sober the whole time. You know, my experience with sponsorship has been 100% successful. Is those guys, not the guys I've sponsored, but I've stayed sober 100% of the time. So I'm not going to stop doing it. I've had so many different things for areas in my life where I've been able to practice the 11th step. Very difficult to do when you've got real life problems on the line. I've been up for multiple felony charges. And while I was in rehab, things from the past, and I had to pray and got guidance to just go in and be honest. Now my attorney, while he agrees, he thinks everybody ought to go to AA. He did not agree with my guidance. You know, he's like, being honest, bad idea. He's like, you need to go in here and lie your ass off. And so I had to make a decision. You know, when you get guidance, what do you do with it? Do you obey it, or you just do what you want to do? And that's what they taught me. They taught me you got to follow this path, and that's what this means. Do the next right thing. Once you know what the next right thing to do is, you got to do it. I went into court, and I went and talked to a DA, and I sat down, and I said, look, I said, everything on that piece of paper right there is true. All that stuff I did. But the guy standing in front of you is not that guy. I mean, multiple felony charges, I'm not that guy. I've spent several months working intensively with another alcoholic who was taking me through this program, and I have had a personality change sufficient to overcome drinking and using, and I've had a profound alteration in the way that I react to life. And that I didn't say, but that I knew, because I was ready. If they put me in jail, I was gonna go smiling, you know? And I went before a judge. The judge said, you know, most of my charges were fraud. He said, these people just want their money back. Do you have it? No. You know, he said, can you get it? And I said, yeah, I'm working $9 an hour job, stocking shelves. No one knows six figures has gone away. This is what I was doing. And it was the most honest job I'd ever had. And he said, well, you're going to pay it back over time. And I spent the last 6 years paying all that back, and paying back my MAR bill that had gone up sky high through the roof. And then I got a better job. I got a good job from a guy I met in the program. You know, everything that's good in my life today is a direct result of working these steps. Everything. There's not one thing. Not one thing I have. I got a house right around the corner here. It's a nice house. You know, I got a car. I got a this. I got a that. I got a little money in the bank. All a direct result of working this program. Everything. I lost my job. Man, let me tell you, life doesn't stop just because you get sober and stay sober. All the same stuff that happens in life continued to happen around me and to me, but the way I react to it is very different today. My perfect? Hell no. I screw up all the time. I have to make amends all the time. My status on Facebook 2 days ago was my 10th step tonight is going to take an hour because I had a lot of people that I had to go back and apologize to and make up for things that I had said and done. But I have been around now and gone through enough stuff that I know that when I have something happen in my life, that the next thing that's going to happen is something good, because God is working in my life. It tells us in the book, you know, He'll provide what we need. We stay close to Him and perform His work well. And man, I stay close as I can, and I do the best I can, and God has provided everything I needed. When I lost my job, I had an opportunity to do something I've always wanted to do, and that's work with other alcoholics in a different way instead of just one-on-one. I wanted to open a recovery residence, and I was blessed to do that with the help of some people in this program. We started a little small recovery residence, and it's gotten a little bit bigger. And I have had a front row seat watching people recover, watching people come in, shot out. I'm not going to mention Sarah's name, but I have watched people come in, shot out, and have an absolute miracle happen to them because they did exactly the same thing I did, and that is just become willing to follow directions. Just willing to follow directions, even when it gets hard. And man, you can't, having a little bit of honesty, a little bit of open-mindedness to, you know, some of this God and spiritual stuff that we might be afraid of or prejudiced against, and having a little bit of willingness, that will take you such a long way in this program. And I remember you know, one of the most powerful things that my sponsor said to me, because I was complaining just about this and that, and I was calling him. He lives in Alabama now, and I still talk to him every day. I'm so grateful for everything this program has given me. I called him the other day, and I'm complaining, and he goes, "Trey, life's a bitch." He said, "Because if it was a slut, it'd be easy."